Welcome, everybody, and good morning. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And, of course, I'm Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show. And we're going to tackle a really important subject. I was part of an email thread that went on last week that was started by people like Ethelbert Miller and John Kavanagh from IPS, Ethelbert Miller being one of our great poets who used to be at Howard University, and many others, James Early. Around what happened at the rally for Bernie Sanders in Seattle on August the 8th, where Black Lives Matter protesters stood up and took the podium and took over for a bit and raised some issues around Black Lives Matter at a rally that was to center around Medicare and Social Security and had been organized by a multiracial, multicultural coalition in Seattle and brought Bernie Sanders in to speak. And that then what happened after that, after Simone Sanders and got up and made her speech, was that Bernie Sanders was very flustered, didn't continue. People stood there for an hour waiting to hear him speak. It didn't happen. But what it did highlight in many ways for many people was the split, the kind of the divergent ideas and lack of communication has been happening between what people consider the left progressive part of the Democratic Party, which people consider many people being in white, but not everybody, and the black and brown communities in the United States and the Black Lives Matter movement. And the whole question now for America must wrestle with, which is the question of, even Hillary Clinton has now just said, that she says we have to deal with the sin of America, the sin that was, hope she means, racism and white supremacy in this country and what that means. And it has taken hold of this country, taken hold of the political conversation here. And so many people were calling for in this conversation, is it possible for people like Bernie Sanders and others to marry the discussion and ideas of economic justice with racial justice in this country and where this divide is? So we are going to wrestle with this in this panel we're having today that we're doing in collaboration with The Nation magazine and with a roundtable of guests from around the country. The complexity of this relationship between presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders, Black Lives Matter, and the 2016 presidential race, and more. I'm joined by Kai Wright, who is the features editor of The Nation, where he wrote Black Lives Matter is a Demand, Not a Plea. Faraj Muhammad joins us. He's host of Listen Up here on WEAA 88.9 FM, Youth Empowerment Coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee here in Baltimore, and also heard now on WOLB every morning. State Senator Pramila Jayapal, who is a represents District 37 in the Washington State Senate since January 2015, and wrote a really, I think, important and moving piece, piece to wrestle with why the Bernie Sanders rally left me heartbroken, and Erica Blount-Danois, who's a journalist, writer, editor, and professor who wrote In the Root, Bernie Sanders, Black Lives Matter, and the Search for a Black Agenda. And welcome. It's good to have all four of you with us here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me, if I might start, Pramila, with you, just because it actually this started for me when I saw the. Before we start that, we have a clip of the rally. I want our listeners to get a chance to hear that, and this is what people experienced at the very beginning when this took place. Let's play that first, and then we'll turn to Pramila.
We have a message for you and a message for Bernie. But first, we wanted our chance to welcome Bernie to Seattle. I was going to tell Bernie how racist the city is, filled with its progressives, but you already did it for me. Thank you. Now that you've covered yourself in your white supremacist liberalism, I will formally welcome Bernie Sanders to Seattle. Bernie Sanders, I would like to welcome you to this place called Seattle, which is actually occupied Duwamish land, stolen, and hypocritically named after Chief Self. We are located in King County, where the silhouette of Martin Luther King reigns high while we spend $210 million building a new jail to imprison black children.
So that was just a piece of what happened in these first in these 20 minutes when the young women from the Black Lives Matter movement in Seattle took over that stage. And State Senator Pramila Jayapal, you helped organize this rally. You spoke just before this happened. So talk a bit about what your reaction to all this was, when it happened, and what it means now for you.
Yeah, I actually didn't organize it, but I knew all the people
okay,
that organized it very well. I was an activist for 20 years before becoming a state senator on immigrant, civil, and human rights. And so they were all friends of mine up there. And I just happened to be the speaker right before Bernie Sanders. And when these women got up on stage, one of the, you know, I think what happened, and it wasn't universal across the crowd, there were probably 5,000 people. But what I could see standing right up front is that the, you know, people started immediately booing them. They had been waiting for a while to hear Bernie. It was hot. But it turned ugly very quickly, at least within a portion of the crowd. Middle fingers were raised. People were screaming at them. They, you know, they didn't mince their words about what they had to say. They, at one point, it wasn't on your clip, but at one point they called everybody in the audience racist. And the crowd very quickly turned against them, and the quality of the anger was palpable. I mean, not just from them, but from the crowd. And you kind of felt like, I mean, I guess I felt like this was a very thin veneer of support for the Black Lives Movement that broke very quickly. That's really what made me heartbroken. And the part about, you know, seeing these women on stage articulating a lot of the deep anger, resentment, frustration with a so-called progressive, mostly white, the audience was mostly white, but a so-called progressive audience, a so-called progressive city, and really being booed off of stage. And that whole scene was deeply disturbing. There were two young women who, they were the sisters of one of our speakers, Marcellus Owens, African-American women who, girls actually, I think maybe 12 and 14, who were right up next to me in the speaker's tent. And they started sobbing, and I just went over to them and put my arms around them. They were just afraid with the anger of the crowd. And they kept saying, I'm so afraid, I'm so afraid. There were some bottles, water bottles that were thrown at the women. And I think you saw this incredible eruption of emotion. And what happened after that was, you know, Bernie Sanders left. He didn't speak. He was there for about an hour, but he kind of stepped aside. The organizers were made a very clear decision that they did not want the women arrested, which I'm very grateful for. I think that they, you know, they wanted to kind of allow the process to move forward. They gave the women a chance to speak. The women took the mic, spoke some of what you heard, and then asked for a 4.5 minute time of silence for Michael Brown. And because it was the day before the anniversary of his death. And so when they did that, in the beginning, the crowd didn't want to be quiet, but then everyone did quieten down. They had sort of made it seem like once that silence was over, that Bernie Sanders would get the mic and be able to speak. After the moment of silence, after the 4.5 minutes of silence, it became clear that they were not going to allow Sanders to speak. And it got worse after that. And so Bernie left. And the rally got shut down. And the next day, but after that, actually, I spoke to Bernie Sanders, and I can talk a little bit about that. I had a meeting set up with him separately because for a whole bunch of reasons. I wanted to talk to him about race and his positions on race. And I was one of the five people that was introducing him that night. I hadn't endorsed him, mainly because of my questions around race. And so I had a chance to speak to him, and I think that he understood at that point that that was a very interesting conversation to go into, but he understood at that point that it wasn't enough just to have policies that address the symptoms of racism, but really what I was asking for, in the words of the Black Lives protesters, was you need to address institutionalized racism head on. And he actually did that night. He got even stronger, I think, over the week. The next morning, I couldn't sleep, and I wrote a piece. This is a Facebook post that ended up going viral very quickly, and that's the piece that you referred to.
Right.
And what it tells me is that these conversations, regardless of what you think of the tactics, regardless of whether you think that was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, the conversations that people are having are absolutely essential. And I'll say that I think that the women created space for us to also have these conversations with presidential candidates. I've gotten calls from top-level elected officials in my state asking, what should we do if this happens? And my answer is, do you have a racial justice platform? Are you fighting for it? Where does this figure in your policymaking? And that's a conversation I'm not sure would have happened if these protesters had not taken over the stage the way that they did.
And I wonder, you know, Kai Wright, I mean, you work at The Nation, one of the nation's leading progressive magazines, that many, many people look at as a magazine that is mostly white, with mostly white readers, and is now wrestling with this as well, I think. So I wonder what you think this larger thing says about the nature of the progressive movement in America, of the left in America, that is being forced to kind of in some ways confront the issue of racism head on, where, you know, it was safe to support from a distance.
Yep.
But now something else is happening.
I mean, I'd say beyond The Nation's readership, you know, I, as a black man who has written about race and racial justice and for a long time and spent a lot of my career talking to and amongst progressive communities, it is what Pramila describes is not surprising, right? I mean, there is progressive white people are Americans just like everybody else. And this is a nation that is struggling with understanding how to deal with race. We always have struggled with it. And then over the generation, I'm 40, over the course of my lifetime, we have been through an era in which our politic has been about aggressive political culture that aggressively erases the idea of institutionalized racism, and so that says that the best way for you to deal with race is to ignore it and to be blind to it, and so a great many people, left, right, and center, that's where they're at, and that's where they've been at for a long time, and we've entered a time in American history where amongst black folks at least, but I would argue that we see it in immigrant communities as well and other places where we're kind of done negotiating with white people about the existence of racial injustice, and that is a jarring moment that for the whole country, regardless of your politics, that's a jarring moment. When people of color say, "Well, we're not going to negotiate the existence of the problem anymore. We're going to move forward," and that's a big break from our political culture over the course of my entire life, and it's a big break from particularly our political culture during the Obama era. And so that's challenging. That's challenging to people, and it's going to be.
And I think it is challenging. And Faraji, I mean, again, you work in an institution that is also very racially mixed and run by mostly white folks, mm-hmm. American Friends Service Committee.
Right.
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 And I was thinking about what Kai just said, that I think that it reminds me in some ways of the SNCC and the Civil Rights Movement, when people then said, we are not going to sit back and wait. We're going to push this and break the back of terrorism and break the back of segregation in the South. We're not waiting to be nice anymore. Mm-hmm. Niceness is over.
Right.
In some sense, this is a 21st century version, but an update where race, as Kai was saying, we're not negotiating. It's there. It's real. We have to deal with it. But I think part of it is that most people in America, most people who are not black Americans, don't understand the depth or the importance of racism. And I think that's part of what's on the table, and that's part of what people like Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley and many other politicians don't quite get, is the depth and importance of race in American society, culture, economics, and politics.
I think what you're speaking about, Mark, is something that's very central, which is denial, which is, you know, you recognize it, but at the same time, you don't want to believe it, because we have always... America has gone through the phase of well, has gotten the consciousness of American exceptionalism, like we're better than this, we're greater than this. And that's the imagery that we've oftentimes put out to the rest of the globe, to the rest of the world. However, as we put that American exceptionalism out there, we're still befuddled and challenged by the race issues in America and Ferguson. And if we go back 50 years to Watts, and if we look at all of those
50 years now.
Right. I mean, if we look at right. 50 years ago and Watts, I was having a conversation with a reporter from the Los Angeles Times, and I said, listen, the crazy part about Watts is that the black man that was the source of that issue didn't die. The police didn't automatically make a judgment and say, we're going to shoot him. It was just a simple fact that he was arrested the way he was, along with his family. But he was there to tell his story later on. But when you get to this point now, where this race issue has gotten so big, and that, you know, I think about some of the things that we're seeing, and then I'm hearing a clip. The Black Lives Matter movement resonates with a lot of folks, but it's also starting to, I don't want to say mocked, but it's starting to feel mocked because everybody's attaching whatever they want to something matters, you know. And at the same time, it starts to downplay the importance and the value of race. You can't talk about any other issue or any other group of people that are suffering the same way that black people in America have suffered over at least the past 50 years. And we don't have to go back hundreds of hundred years. We could just say over the past 50 years. And so when you're talking about the depths and importance of it, you really, and especially as a presidential contender, you really have to understand that. And what the current president is finally coming to terms with is that if he's talking about really making a change in America, he's going to have to do some dramatic things that's going to put a dent, at least in the perception, at least in some of the structural issues that we suffer here in America in terms of race. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of moral victories with no tangible wins. And we're at this point, Mark, that if you have that type of moral victory, I've took down the flag or we've interrupted a rally, that's a moral victory. But at the end of the day, did that really push the envelope enough to get people to say that, you know what, political policy-wise, institutionally, curriculum within the schools, all of these other things is going to trickle down, is going to make a change. That's what we're working for. We're looking for tangible wins on the race relations issue, not just moral victories.
And I think one of the things that's happening, what happened when Marissa Johnson and Mara Jacqueline Williford jumped up on that platform, Erica, is that at least in the liberal progressive end of America, in the non-African American political progressive world, that people are now being forced to look at something in the eye that nobody wanted to look at in the eye before. It was easy to support Black Lives Matter when you were standing on the side. It was easy to say that what happened to Ferguson was wrong, what happened to Eric Garner in New York was wrong, what happened here in Baltimore was wrong, that those things were should not happen. But then you have to deal with what that means for the greater for the depth of our society. That's when I think we're at the point now mm-hmm. that's being pushed, that people do not yet know, Erica, how to address. Or how to consume.
I agree. I think, you know, when the Black Lives Matter movement has forced, you know, many of the candidates to even begin to address, you know, progressives that we would think would automatically be addressing these issues, this has forced them to, you know, in the case of Bernie Sanders, to create a racial justice tab. It has forced them to start to deal with, you know, all of the things that Black Lives Matter movement have been, you know, talking about. Like Faraji said, you know, it's you know, race and justice right now, it may be the most important issue
yeah.
in the country. And
yep.
it's affecting, you know, when you talk about, you know, moral conscience, you can appeal to people's moral conscience. But I think beyond that, you know, when I talked to Don Rojas for my article about, you know, he talked about reparations as part of a black agenda. And I asked, well, you know, why would white supremacists be concerned about having, you know, giving reparations economic justice for, you know, slavery? And I said, you know, he
you know, talked about, you know, the moral conscience of the country, et cetera, which is, you know, it's that is something that is relevant. However, I think when you talk about how it's going to affect the economy, you know, in the instance of, you know, the housing crisis, it was primarily a result of predatory lending and people being discriminatory against, you know, primarily black people that caused the, you know, the recession that we're in. So you have to talk about the bottom line in addition and talk about how racial injustice affects everybody, and it will eventually, you know, even, you know, insofar as police brutality, eventually it will affect everybody if it's not dealt with in you know, like Faraji said, in a structural manner.
So let me ask a very political question here, and Pramila, let me come back to you, if I might, Jayapal, to kind of wrestle with this first. Let's talk about this for a moment, that every political campaign I can remember in living memory in the last 50, 60 years in America has touched on some level about race, whether it was Willie Horton and putting the face up there to play on the racist fears of white America to get a vote, or what happened in the 60s when the movement began and exploded. There's something that's always been built around race. But the difference here now, it seems to me, is that we are being confronted with how to deal with the fact that the rage in the black community at the moment is out of the history of this country. The capitalist system we have today wouldn't exist if it had not been for the theft of native lands and then taking those lands and enslaving Africans to build the economy of the world. Mm-hmm. And so to the depth of that is coming to fore in some ways in what happened in Seattle. So the question is, how do we begin to for the political leaders to address that? I mean, you deal with those people every day. You've been an activist for 20 years, but now you're a state senator. And now you're a state, yeah. And now you're a state senator. So this is this is a new agenda we're dealing with here of marrying racial and economic justice.
It really is. And, you know, I'm the only woman of color in the state Senate.
The only one.
49, the only one. And out of 49, I think we have 5 people of color total, but I'm the only woman of color in the state Senate.
Wow.
And so I am dealing with it every day. And you know, I think the big difference here is that while race has come up in political campaigns in the past, while there is some touching on it here and there, I think the difference is now it's not just, you know, sort of the bad guys on the conservative side versus the good guys on the progressive side.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's actually white progressives in our movement that have to look at what is the role of the moderate white or even the progressive white in furthering racism and institutionalized racism and not calling it out and not doing anything active to actually put it at the front of their agenda? And that's what's really struck me out of, you know, I've gotten thousands and thousands of responses to the post, and I started just going through and categorizing them into different categories. And, you know, I think that white people, progressive white people, are trying to figure out where they can stand in this movement. And I do think we have to figure out a way and a place for them to stand with us if they want to. But I also think that I went back and read Martin Luther King's, you know, letter from the Birmingham jail, and I can't believe how close the words are.
Yeah.
You know, for what's in that letter back in the 60s and what we're dealing with today, and exactly the responses, which is part of the reason I was cutting and pasting from what I'm getting, because, you know, people say, well, I agree with your goals, but not your tactics, right? That was exactly what he talks about. And one of the things that has been really disturbing out of the responses, and I'll say I've gotten tremendously good responses from white people who are like, I now see that I need to do more. What do I do? How do I give up my white privilege? How do I erase this stuff? That's all, you know, I think positive. But I've also gotten emails from people who have said things like, I used to support the Black Lives Movement, but after this, I can't possibly support it. You know, and I think, well, how deep was your support?
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what we're doing is challenging the depth and the urgency, because I think that's the other thing is, I've had some people say to me, well, this was a Social Security rally, and it overshadowed something that's very important. And certainly Social Security has been very important, including for African Americans. But that is not understanding the urgency of the lack of response over the last, really, centuries, but certainly the last 50 years, in addressing institutional and individual racism. And that's, I think, you know, one of the things that I think we have to figure out is what do we want from white people? And how do we get there?
And white people. And so much.
We do want from white
And, you know, I was in the same compassionate place when I wrote the piece on Sunday, but by Tuesday, I was in a very angry place. And I said to a couple of my good friends who are white, including my partner, I said, you white people just need to go talk to each other, you know, and figure it out. Don't come and try to process it with me. Because I think, you know, we can help to have these conversations on radio, but I don't really want to be the person that gets processed with through people trying to figure out where they stand in this. Some of that work really does have to be done by white people amongst white people. And then I think we have to figure out how do we use these moments to continue to try to allow for the division to happen, but also give people a place to stand so that we can continue to be stronger and unified as we go forward.
We're talking to Washington State Senator Pramila Jayapal, the nation's Kai Wright, WEA's Faraja Muhammad, and the Roots' Erica Blant Downwa about Black Lives Matter, presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders, this 2016 presidential race here in collaboration with The Nation magazine. We have to take a very short break. We're coming right back to continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are here with State Senator Pramila Jayapal, who wrote the piece, Why the Bernie Sanders Rally Left Me Heartbroken, for the Huffington Post. It started out as a blog. She represents District 37 in the Washington State Senate since January of 2015. Kai Wright is the features editor for The Nation magazine, who wrote Black Lives Matter is a Demand, Not a Plea. Faraja Muhammad is host of Listen Up here at WEA 80.9 FM and the Youth Empowerment Coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee. And Erica Blant Downwa wrote the piece Bernie Sanders, Black Lives Matter, and the Search for a Black Agenda in the Root, and joins us also here today by phone. So coming back to where we left off here, so and picking up on what Pramila just said, Faraja, I know you wanted to jump in, and I felt like everybody was getting ready to jump in on that piece. But so the question is, you know, when you have this kind of this thin veneer that kind of covers this kind of glaring light of racism in America, kind of trying to black it out, but it can't be blacked out anymore. Maybe that's the wrong word to use, but it can't be.
Widen out.
It could widen out. Wait, thank you.
That's so racist.
Leave it to me. But so, but the question I'm going to pick up is what Pramila left off with. And so, if a political movement is trying to be built in America to change the nature of inequality in this country, economic inequality, end of racial injustice in America, they're deeply connected. Somehow, while the white world has to wrestle, the non-black world has to wrestle with the roots of racism in this country, mm-hmm. we also have to build a movement at the same time that wrestles with the economic justice that's all wrapped up in racial injustice. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. We're at a really important point, I think, in history. We just don't know it yet.
I think, Michael.
Maybe we do. I don't know.
Well, you know, I think we are, and I think it takes a lot of courage as two groups of people to make the decision on which way we're going to go. But the key part of our decision making has to be two principles, which are truth and justice. And as we know, justice is the principle of fair dealing, and truth is any principle that can be proven over time. And that stands the test of time. And what we're looking at this point is, you know, folks ask, well, you know, I've had the same conversations and where I've had white folks come up to me and say, well, what can I do? First, let's be honest with yourself and be honest about the history of where you are and what this country is. And let's be honest. And I mean, really internally be honest and open and receptive that this country is schizophrenic in a sense that it has two different realities for black people and white people. And I think that once we start that process, like that truthful reflection about where this country is and who we are and our history, then I think we can move forward. A lot of the part of the issue about reparations and even with Black Lives, a lot of that is because it gets muddled with emotion. It gets muddled with, well, that you know, you guys have slavery too. There were Africans selling Africans and all of this stuff. And then it becomes the blame game and all of these things. And I think that that's the problem, that if there isn't any truthful dialogue about where things are, then we'll never move forward. The other part of it is that if you aren't really... If you can honestly say that a Black man or versus a white man or whatever in terms of the system, that those two individuals are not going to be are not going to get this from what they need to get from the system in a just manner. They're not, justice is not going to be present in that Black man's life as much as it is going to be present in that white man's life. Regardless, I know that, it, you know, socioeconomic backgrounds and all of those things, and there are certainly some different factors, but essentially, the system is not designed for Black people to truly become empowered.
So in some ways, Kai, it seems to me that the white progressive politicals in this political people in this country have to stop being afraid of issues of race and racism in the political sphere because they're afraid of losing elections and begin to deal with the depth of it so we can build something new.
Well, I mean, on a lot of levels. And so to back up to something you're familiar with, about the Social Security and Medicare rally and folks saying, oh, well, this was an important issue. And in fact, you cannot understand the challenges being that you cannot understand the political challenge to Social Security and Medicare without understanding race. The reason why these are all programs that were all of these programs were created out of the Great Society in the 1960s as a specific response to racial injustice. And we have spent the last 50 years fighting over whether or not they are a legitimate response to racial injustice. That's actually what the Social Security fight is about, and the Republican Party is not confused about that. But what has been happening since at least the mid-90s in the Democratic Party, left, right, and center, has been a consensus that the effective way to win is to be race neutral. That we have to think about all of these fights from a class perspective. We have to think about immigration reform from a race neutral perspective. We have to think about poverty alleviation from a race neutral perspective. And the consequence of doing so has been defeat. Has been defeat after defeat after defeat. And if you do, and so what this election is about and what we're experiencing now from the Black Lives Matter movement, and again, so how do we move, going back to this really important idea, from a moral win to a cut to a political win, is that the reason why the moral win is important is because the how we frame the debate is important. And if Democrats, Republicans too, but writing them off for the moment on this discussion, if people who wish to be elected to office and want my support and want the support of the Black community and want the support of people who really want to see equity in this country are not able to center race in their policy discussion, then it's not going to work. And we have seen that. We've just seen it. We didn't center race in the immigration reform fight, and we have had more deportations than in the history of our country. We have not centered race in a conversation about economic inequity. 30%, nearly 30% of Black Americans live below the poverty line. Mm. That's a shocking stat. Nearly 30%. There are, I believe, 13 states in which nearly 40% of Black Americans live below the poverty line. There is one state, Kentucky, where that's the case for white people. So the last 15 years at least of economic and social politics led by Democrats has failed Black America, and it has failed immigrant communities. And we could go further, I'm sure. It's been a failure specifically because we've decided not to center race in these policy discussions. And so that's what the ask is for 2016. That's what this moment's about. And up until a couple of weeks ago, Bernie Sanders was not centering race in his campaign.
Was not. No, exactly.
And
was
now
not.
He is. And so he's a better candidate for it. He's both a better candidate politically and more likely to actually achieve his ends of creating economic equity.
And it shows you the depth of this. And Faraj, I'll come to you, and I'll come right to Pramila and then go to Erica, because I do want you to jump in here. He said, when we use those stats about people living in poverty, 30%, 40%, I want people to keep in mind as they're listening to this that that's a definition of poverty that is 50 years old and almost irrelevant to the 21st century.
Wow, so there could potentially be more.
The numbers, when you look at other people's studies, the numbers are much larger than that in reality. They're not 30%, they're closer to 40 and 50%.
Yeah, right. That's a minimum.
Right.
That's minimum.
I mean, and here's the and as I was listening to Kai, it made me think about what happened with the Freddie Gray situation here in Baltimore. You know, that constant question, and I think it's one of those questions about, well, why would you destroy your own community? You know, we saw that. Oh, why would they destroy their own community? And I'm thinking to myself, that's the problem. The problem is that folks want to make revolution or any type of dramatic change comfortable and put into a box, and it's clean and it's well packaged. And the way they do that is by pacifying us and say, well, why don't you take your issues to the polls? And I tell people all the time, that's not going to be sufficient based upon the condition and the issues that we're facing in this country, that you can't vote your way out of this. Why keep voting for a particular candidate when the system is still the same way? And the candidate does not have the power to totally overturn and put the system on its head. The candidate gets into the system with good intentions, but they might come out after a 4-year stint with, well, it didn't work, but we were able to come out with a compromise. We don't need compromises at this point. So we can't stop making the movement so comfortable, so packaged. It has to be messy. It has to be uncomfortable. It has to be a dark period. It has to make people a little afraid. But at the same time, no great idea or no great change comes in a very comfortable manner.
So Pramila, before I go to Erica, Pramila, I want to ask you this question as somebody who's active in the Democratic Party and now is a state senator with Democrat in your name. And when you go to Democratic National Conventions, you see that the majority of people in those conventions are not white men. They are white women and people of color. And that in that world, and you still see, though, the people sitting up front and running the place are still mostly white men. So in that milieu, which is where this started taking place between Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley and now with Hillary Clinton. How does that begin to change? How do what we talk about here begins to become the discussion of economic and racial justice together? How does that happen?
I'll tell you, that is the reason I ran for office. It's not because I actually wanted to run for office. In fact, I spent years saying, no, I'm not going to run. You know, turned my nose up, probably just like everybody else on the phone, like, that's corrupt. You know, I don't want to get in that
right.
system. The whole thing. But what I realized is after 20 years of trying to get these people to do what I want them to do, why the hell are we not in there trying to do it ourselves? You can't, you know, and I know that there's different views on this, but I feel like we are not going to win just trying to do it from the outside. We're also not going to win, by the way, with only one woman of color in a state senate. I mean, we have to increase our numbers on the inside, and we have to create an alternate inside-outside organizing strategy so that we are starting to elect not just people of color, but movement electives, people who come from the movement, whose allegiance to the movement is going to continue in the face of what I will say is extremely strong pressure from within the political structure. Once you get in, it's all about your, you know, who are you loyal to? How do you get your committee appointments? How do you get your chairmanship or your ranking member or whatever. But unless we create an alternate structure on the outside that supports candidates once they get in and really does an inside-outside strategizing, I don't think we're going to change it. But I also don't think that that's the only answer. There is room in this movement. There's a need in this movement for all kinds of tactics. And I'm all for disruptive tactics because I think it creates the space that then perhaps different people jump into that space to take it forward from there. But we have to recognize that we need a number of different tactics in the movement. Some are loving tactics. I wrote this in my piece. Some are disruptive tactics. Some are truth-telling tactics. Some can only be taken on by white people. Some can only be taken on by people of color. But we really need that whole set of tools in the toolbox. And I think what Kai said about, you know, centering race is just one of the most important things here in this conversation, because so many people, including Bernie Sanders at the beginning, even when I had the chance to speak to him one-on-one, talked about race as if it is just a piece of one system, say the criminal justice system, right? Or they talk about it in the sense of class. And I have many people say to me, how can you say Bernie Sanders isn't addressing race when he's talking about income inequality and people of color are disproportionately poor? And my answer to that is, if you do not name institutional racism in every system, threaded through everything and as its own thing, then you simply don't understand. You can address issues of poverty and you can still have black people at the bottom of the ladder, which in fact is where we are today. And so I think that issue is just so important for people to understand. And I think Bernie Sanders is finally understanding that it needs to be addressed on its own. It needs to be called out as institutional racism. It is not enough just to address the symptoms of it or just to talk about the criminal justice system. Because, you know, I just saw statistics in this state. By the age of 2, kids are being suspended and disciplined differently because of the color of their skin. 2, we're talking child care at this point. And so that, I think, is very, very important. And then the other poignant thing that makes me think about is, you know, with politicians and talking about race, within a month of being in office, I called a meeting of some of our top black pastors and black activists. And I said, what's our agenda? What should our ask be in the legislature, state policy, that we all want to put our names behind? And we had some really good discussions, and we've continued those discussions, and we're trying to develop that together. But one of the things that one of them said to me is, you know, this is so unusual to have somebody talk to us about race at the beginning of their term, because normally what happens is they have to be out of office to decide they want to work on racial justice issues, or they have to be at the end of their term and you know, trying to make sure that they're preserving their legacy, right? I mean, this rings very true with where President Obama is today.
Yeah.
And so, I just think that that's a very telling thing. It is not easy, and I will say this, it is very, very difficult to hold the banner for race and racial justice and still be, you know, able to kind of live your day in the state Senate when you're the only woman of color, when you're one of very few people of color, when the tradition is to, you know, not call out things in ways that are uncomfortable, even though the Republicans, by the way, do it all the time. But either it's used as a tool, just a divisive tool, but not necessarily a strategy to achieve a real legislative result, or it's not called out at all.
Erica,
and so you have to decide where you're going to be in those conversations, and you can't be the one always raising the banner on your own. It's way too difficult.
Mm.
And I think sometimes that gets seen as compromise or giving in. But it's also just tiring, and sometimes
right.
It's strategic. So it's a little of all of those.
Erica?
Well, you know, you talked about economic injustice. I have some radical ideas on how we can begin to address it, and one of them was with Truth and Reconciliation Committees. And, you know, talking specifically, you know, I don't know how that would look, but, you know, the banks that have profited from slavery or, you know, people who have profited from Jim Crow or schools or what have you. But yeah, I think what Siraji is saying in terms of, you know, starting with the truth is, you know, that's the source of the problem. And I think, you know, from there we can move in a variety of different directions. But, you know, also in talking about the political system, you know, it's flawed in and of itself. So, you know, if it weren't, we would be able to have a Green Party candidate that was viable. And, you know, we never have had even anyone that's close to being viable. So, you know, there may need to be a complete restructuring of the political system as it stands now in order to get to a place where we can even start to talk about, you know, radical ideas from, you know, Truth and Reconciliation or reparations
right.
or what have you.
And I think that's an important point, Erica. You know, Kai, I was wondering as I was listening to what Erica just said and what Pramila just said, this might sound strange, but let me throw it out there, given this political world and who we are in America as a people and how difficult it was for Barack Obama in many ways as president to begin to raise these issues for lots of complex reasons we don't have to go into at this moment. But maybe in some ways it takes a Bernie Sanders, it takes a white voice to put those issues front and center.
Well, it takes a leader.
It does, but you know what? But yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I agree. I think that's actually sadly true.
And that leadership can come in all kinds of forms. Sure, maybe it's a white leader, maybe it's a black leader, but it takes leadership. You know, I'm not one who's prepared to say that Barack Obama could do no more. He was able to use the power of his office for a great many things that he wanted to use his power of his office for. He was able to expand the presidential killing campaign, for instance. He was able to use his office to deport 2 million people. He was able to use his office for a great many things that he sought to do. So I'm not prepared to simply say, oh, he had no power. He chose not to center race, and he may have chosen it, and we can, history will debate whether and why he made that choice, but it was a choice that the President of the United States, one of the most powerful people on earth, made, and I'm not prepared to say he didn't have that power, that was beyond his control. But we have seen other presidents and other elected officials make the choice to center race, and so it is doable. They have necessarily been white, given our history. But I think ultimately we miss the point if we don't understand it, is that what it takes is leadership. And in order to have that leadership, all of us have to create the environment to empower it. But ultimately, it takes leadership.
And in this country, whenever there's been a monumental change like this, that the black community in America has been at the forefront of that just by the nature of what this country is and what was created in this country. So I'm very curious about what you all four think about what I started to talk about with Pramila a few moments ago is how this advances. You know, I want to ask what you think about this. I mean, there are a number of activists in the Black Lives Matter movement and others who have written that they didn't trust Bernie Sanders because he hired Simone Sanders to be a young African-American woman to be his communications director, his press secretary, and that was suspect to some people, and then all of a sudden came out the platform on racism and racial justice. So, I mean, because there's always this kind of second-guessing and also distrust. I think that goes to the heart of it, no matter how honest or what Bernie Sanders was or not in that. So, I mean, to me, that also speaks to the divide that we're facing. I'm curious what we all think here about where this may go, where this future may take us. Go ahead.
It'll be step by step, but I mean, I would say that actually, speaking specifically to Bernie Sanders' campaign, he has shown leadership that I'm asking for in recent weeks. He's been pressured and he's responded. He said, well, let's center a black woman who comes from this movement in my campaign. Let's develop a meaningful racial justice platform. And it is a meaningful platform, and let's center it. That's leadership. He got there the hard way, but he got there. So I think we're seeing that. I think we're also seeing it, frankly, in Hillary Clinton's campaign. She has, and I think we can blame or thank movements for this over the course. the beginning of her campaign, she has centered a number of racial justice campaigns. She centered racial justice organizers in her campaign, and so I think we are in fact seeing a shift, at least in the Democratic Party, as a consequence of the activism of the past year. We're seeing that shift, and so we will. Where is it going to go? We're certainly going to continue to see the pressure, and we'll see whether the leadership continues to follow from that pressure.
Now, Erica, I mean, and I'll go to Faraji, and we'll close up with Pramila. Are you as comfortable with that as I hear Kai might be? Well, that's not fair to say, because Kai raised some difficult issues with that, about where that might be going.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Bernie Sanders did was not just smart, but, you know, also, you know, when you ask what can white people do, that he did what white people can do. He listened, and he knew that, you know, he was limited in his understanding of what racial justice would mean. So he hired someone who may know better. So I think, you know, what he is perhaps our best, you know, hope for the future. However, I think it's smart, too, to be skeptical because, you know, who's to say that this is part of his campaign and not part of his presidency? So, you know, it's smart to also be skeptical about, you know, what that means for the future. So I think both ways are, you know, it makes sense.
I think that what Kai brings up, it kind of hit me, hit a different chord for me, because if you're talking about leadership, he should have already, Bernie Sanders in particular, and all of the presidential candidates should have already included some sort of racial justice component into their platform. They shouldn't have to have been forced, because the question is, where would that racial justice component be if there wasn't any pressure put on them? Would they have said, oh, we need to have a black woman, oh, we need to speak about this, if there weren't any protesters in the beginning? And they were just allowed to kind of go and get on their political, their stomp speech and whatnot. But so a part of me feels like I don't want us to be a line item in a budget or just some bullet point of a policy. I want there to be, when I'm hearing from the president, it should be a part of the essential message of what they're planning to stand on. It shouldn't be like an afterthought or, oh, yeah. Yeah, we need to do something for black people. Yeah, good job. And then it's like something else, you know. So I'm still very skeptical about how these candidates are going to, if they need to be forced. If you know, it's like police officers. If a police officer in this day and time, in this particular climate with community police relations, and they still go out and kill a black man that is unarmed and then come say, well, I didn't know. It's like, really, dude, you didn't know that you could have decided to take another step to eradicate the situation.
And Pramila, this all began in your hometown, and you helped start this also with the article. So let me ask you to kind of close this out for us.
Well, I think that from my discussion with Bernie Sanders, I really believe that he is the perfect person in many ways to knit these threads together. I think that he is not somebody that panders on any level. I mean, he certainly doesn't pander on the class issues. And I don't think he panders on the race issues either. I think my sense of him is that he got a very important message. He wasn't necessarily comfortable with how it was delivered. That's okay with me. My belief is that he is now talking about this and understands the urgency of it in a way that he didn't before all of these protesters at Netroots and then in Seattle raised it. And I think that, you know, I had a chance to talk to Simone Sanders, too. She's a really smart woman who has worked in this arena for some time. She's going to make, I'm sure, her own missteps along the way, because there's so much expectation on her as well and so much judgment, maybe. But I think that it was not the ultimate form of leadership in the sense that he should have known. I agree with that point. But I think he did get it. And I think that the way that he's integrated it into his speeches now is important, because he was talking about the symptoms before and policies to address the symptoms. He just wasn't naming what it was, which tells me he didn't really understand it. And I feel like he's moved in that place. And that's the most that we can, you know, I think that's the most we could hope for from something like this, is that he moves to a place where he is demanding this as part of his platform, talking about it as essential. And that's, I think, what we have to see from the other candidates. I have heard Hillary Clinton talk about some of these things. And, you know, honestly, it's hard for me to, it's easier for me to understand and believe that Bernie Sanders is going to take this up as a critical part of the platform than it is for Hillary. And I say that only because you've got to deal with the big corporations and big interests as well as part of this racial dynamic. And so you're looking for, you know, we're looking for a lot, and I don't think we should minimize what we're looking for. We should keep holding the bar high. We should keep being skeptical. We should keep using lots of tactics, because really that is the only way we're going to move forward. And we certainly, you know, we got to move forward. We can't move back. And we're, you know, we have to refuse to be in the same place and stagnant.
And right now I'd like to thank State Senator Pramila Jayapal, Kai Wright, Faraja Muhammad, Erica Blount-Danois, for joining us for this conversation here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEA, the voice of the community in Baltimore. And also would like to thank Marissa Johnson and Mara Jacqueline Williford for jumping up on the platform and creating this conversation for the nation and progressives to wrestle with, and to thank Nation Magazine for raising the issues like this for the 2016 presidential campaign as the struggle for justice continues. Thank you all so much for taking this hour. It's been a great conversation. I really deeply appreciate it.